When news broke in 1975 that New York City was on the brink of fiscal collapse, few believed it was possible. How could the capital of the financial world go bankrupt? Yet the city was indeed billions of dollars in the red, with no way to pay back its debts. Now historian Kim Phillips Fine has written a new book entitled Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics, that brings this moment in the city's history to life. The name again of the book is Fear City by Kim Phillips Fine, who teaches history at New York University. And it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Kim, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to the story of the 1975 financial crisis in New York City?
Well, there are several different things. I grew up in New York. I'm born in 1975, the same year as the fiscal crisis. So writing this book was really meant writing about the city of my childhood. I also came to the topic after I had finished working on a book about the rise of the conservative movement, and I was amazed by how much vitriol conservatives directed toward New York in the 1970s, and how many articles there were in the conservative press about the city at that time. And then finally, I think I was probably influenced in part by the financial crisis of 2008 and its aftermath. And although I'm not sure I was thinking about this at the time, I was interested in the dynamic of fiscal crisis and how it is that how things can go from appearing all right to be suddenly the awareness that things have gone very wrong.
Certainly, those of us in journalism know that headline very well from the Daily News, Ford to City, Drop Dead. How
Yes.
true was that headline?
Well, that headline appeared, Ford never said the famous words, Ford to City, he never said New York Drop Dead. That headline appeared after he had given a major speech, though, in which he said that he was going to veto any bills that would give aid to New York. And he was, you know, quite clear, I think, in that speech that he would rather see a city go bankrupt than provide federal assistance. So I think that more deeply the speech suggested a underlying lack of compassion for the city, a sense that it had brought its fiscal problems on itself, and a kind of punitive response. So I think that the reaction against it was actually something that Ford himself should have entirely anticipated. It should be noted that a month after he gives that speech, Ford actually does reverse his position. He says New York has started to enact a lot of budget cuts, that the state has provided some aid. He approves of the city's labor unions, bought many of the city's bonds, and he winds up backing some federal loans for the city. But still, the cuts that the city has enacted are ones that are very painful for many New Yorkers. And, you know, Ford really had no problem with this at all. So I think even though he never actually said those words, the kind of spirit that they convey was actually a pretty good reflection of his attitude towards the city.
And the basic problem, to distill it to its simplest form in reading the book, is that you have a very liberal city that was suddenly faced with having to do something extremely conservative.
I guess I would actually put the problem just a bit differently. I think that the problem that emerges in the city is a conflict of visions over what direction New York will take. New York, during the post-war years, has had an unusually generous local welfare state, an extensive city hospital system, free college tuition at the city in the city university, this has expanded still further during the Great Society years with a range of programs directed at very poor people. And for a variety of reasons, in the early 1970s, this becomes difficult to support any longer. the kind of increasing inflow of federal funds that helped make it possible during the 60s is not, it's no longer growing at the same rate. The city is entering a recession and is not able to generate the tax revenue to cover this welfare state that it's created. So there's a kind of a reorientation within the city, and a sense that the need to cut back. Now, was there an absolute need to cut back? I don't think so. I think that you could have found ways with a very different political situation. You could have found ways to finance the kinds of things that New York was doing. Well, with rethinking the relationship between the city and the suburbs, rethinking the relationship between the city and the federal government, the question of who's paying the bill for programs such as Medicaid, those kinds of solutions are completely off the table, and the result is this imperative to enact very steep budget cuts within a very short period of time. And the result is a wave of protests throughout the city as people in neighborhoods that are losing fire protection, losing police services, where libraries are threatened with closure, where schools are closed down. People rise up in great anger against the loss of these services and rights to which they had been accustomed. So I think there's a real conflict in the city over the direction of the future New York.
And we just backing up for a second, the original, when the residents of the city of New York find out that the city is broke, it is a shock to them.
Yes.
This is nothing that they knew was coming.
Well, it's interesting, as is the case probably in many types of fiscal and financial crises. I think there's a way in which people know and don't know at the same time. I think that there was a widespread awareness that the city was in difficulty. There had been newspaper reports about growing anxiety in financial circles. There was an annual struggle over the budget of the city as the mayor would go to Albany asking for additional taxing powers. All of these were well known. I think at the same time, this idea that New York, the largest city in the country, the home of Wall Street, that it could actually contemplate bankruptcy, I think was shocking to people. And it was shocking that banks were refusing to finance the debt of the city any longer. It was shocking that the city, you know, suddenly had to go and beg Washington for additional money. I think even though people knew there were problems, nobody thought that it actually could happen until it was happening.
The title of the book is Fear City, and
yes,
you make the point very clearly that fear was really key to what was going on here. This was a time of fear in the city of New York.
Yes. Well, I take that title, actually. It's drawn from the famous Welcome to Fear City pamphlet that was produced by a coalition of police unions in June 1975 after the mayor, Abraham Beam, announced a round of budget cuts that involved laying off many police officers. And the police unions got together and they produced this flyer. It's a famous flyer with a frightening image of a grinning skull on the front and saying, "Welcome to Fear City," and warning in very kind of lurid, racially charged rhetoric, warning tourists and visitors to the city of New York that, you know, how dangerous the streets of the city would be after dark and so on. They wanted to distribute these at the city's airports to incoming tourists. So that is, you know, the title is drawn from that. But I think that the real dynamic and the cover of the book is not that pamphlet though. The cover of the book is an image of the skyscrapers and skyline of the city, and I think that part of what I'm trying to do is in the book is talk about how fear made people rethink what was possible for the city government to do, and all the different kinds of fear that are circulating in the city. That there is on the one hand, and I think it really is always tinged, kind of charged with a certain racism, the fear of crime and violence in New York. But there's also a fear at the upper levels of the city of what the, you know, that they will be dispossessed by a growing welfare state. There's a fear of the fear of bankruptcy, which animates many and makes it and kind of creates this climate in which it's possible to enact budget cuts that would otherwise never have been politically acceptable, to take power away from the elected city government and give it to people who are appointed by the governor, to make basic decisions about city finances. So there's a way in which fear reorders the politics of New York, and that's the real subject of the book, and one I think that has a lot of resonance with our current situation today.
Kim Phillips-Vine is the author of the new book, Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. You do write that this fiscal crisis of 1975 made it possible for the rise of Donald Trump. He was 29 years old at the time. Talk a little bit about how that rise was made possible by this crisis.
Well, I think this is true in two senses. First is that Trump's own entry into Manhattan real estate is a result of the fiscal crisis, or he, in a complex deal, winds up redeveloping with the Hyatt Regency the Commodore Hotel near Grand Central Terminal, which had been owned by the recently bankrupt Penn Central Railroad and was falling into disrepair. Trump was able to work out a set of tax breaks whereby he and the Hyatt would redevelop this hotel. And he was able to get those kinds of breaks, which were really ultimately worth hundreds of millions of dollars to him and the Hyatt Corporation, because of the fiscal crisis and because the city was desperate for revenue, desperate to prevent parts, you know, neighborhoods from sliding into blight and disrepair, and was eager to find ways to advertise its willingness to make deals with the business community. The Beam administration trumpeted the arrangement with Trump and celebrated it and said, this is a signal that we're sending to companies that we're going to be a very friendly city for business to invest in from this time forward. So in that sense, Trump really entered into Manhattan real estate as a result of the kind of uncertainty that the city was facing in the wake of the crisis. But I think more deeply also, Trump is animated by a vision of cities that dates in part from the 1970s and the fiscal crisis, the sense of cities as dangerous, unpredictable places, sites of American carnage, as he said, where you might get shot on your way to the grocery store. This vision of urban America as inherently dangerous, and also the sense that business people are the only people who have the vision to rescue it, and that their ability to do so depends partly on being willing to ignore democratic protest. I think this vision, too, really dates from the era of the 70s and the fiscal crisis. And, you know, the many ways that cities today are different from cities then, the recovery in some senses, of urban America, the different kinds of problems that cities face today, not to mention the basically undemocratic assumptions about the unique powers of business people. I think none of this really, it hasn't changed Trump's view in a way. His ideas really derive from that moment.
That
seem very linked to them.
Right. That vision, that sense that businessmen are saviors. They will come in and save
right.
the day.
Yes, that they are the ones who have the toughness to do what needs to be done, to make budget cuts, even if those cuts are very destructive of people's lives, to ignore protests from communities that are most directly affected. That sense of business people as the only people who have that capacity.
What do you think the long-term effect has been? Obviously, New York City is once again poised to lose federal funds.
Mm-hmm.
You look at what the vision is of the current mayor, Bill de Blasio, as he ends his first term.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you think we are now in all this?
Well, I think that the New York that emerged out of the fiscal crisis is, you know, in many ways, New York today, many would say, has recovered from the fiscal crisis years. I think, though, that the much more unequal city that exists now is also a product of those years. And your sense of the recovery and health of New York might vary. You know, it looks very different for working class, poor, even middle class people than it does for the economic elite. And I think this is part of what powered de Blasio to the mayoralty in the first place. And the question of whether he's been able to deliver on promises to create a more equal city, you know, I think will affect him in the current mayoral race. I think New York also faces, it does face a real danger in the possibility of losing federal funds, both through the Trump budget and also through Trump's threats to cut funding to cities that don't abide by his anti-immigrant politics. And, New York may again find itself in the position of having to negotiate budget cuts. And what will the city do if it actually loses this money? It's hard to say, but I'm hoping that the city will be able to counter the political narratives that Trump is spinning about it and to defend its social services, defend its policies, and defend the politics that stand behind them, the sense of justice and the kind of what it means to build a city that is, a space of equality and democracy for all.
But it would still be different, right? If the worst happened, it would still be different than what happened in 1975.
Yes, I think that the withdrawal, even if the city lost all of its federal funding, I think there are, the city is actually less dependent on federal funding now than it was in the 1970s, partly the product of a long process of federal disinvestment. Second, the city isn't in the same, at least at this point, the city is not in the same kind of economic difficulties that it was in the mid-70s. And also a whole range of budgeting and accounting procedures have been adopted that would make it, I think, somewhat more difficult for a fiscal crisis to spin out of control in the same way. I also think that the political imagination of the city has been reshaped by the crisis so that it would be, this very deep awareness and fear about the return of fiscal crisis, which I think constrains the city's politics in a lot of ways, but they also, would affect how any actual crisis or any loss of federal funding developed. So yes, I think it will be a big problem if New York loses that money, and how the city will respond, we'll have to see what happens.
This struck me while I was reading the book, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it. Who do you believe the heroes are in the story of coming out of that time in 1975?
Well, I think the book is it was interesting to work on this because I think in a way it is a story without heroes, and at least without heroes in the leadership of the city. In a way, I view the real heroes as the ordinary New Yorkers who tried to protect the public services they were losing, and in the book I talk about some of the activists who tried to keep fire service alive in their neighborhood of North Williamsburg in Brooklyn, who slept in a fire station for 16 months to try to prevent it from closing. I talk about activists at Hostos Community College in the Bronx, a bilingual school, a bilingual two-year community college that was threatened with closure during the crisis, and which they were able to save through their activism. I talk about some of the African-American protesters in Harlem who tried and failed to save Sydenham Hospital, a historically black hospital in that neighborhood. And to me, these ordinary protesters are the real heroes of the book, because I think they were fighting for a more democratic vision of the city. And their insistence that their lives and perspectives matter strike me as truly noble and a vision of engaged citizenship that should have been taken into account more deeply at the time and that we can learn from today.
Again, the name of the book is Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Kim Phillips-Fine is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.